So this is based on, it's actually a continuation of some work I did last year with Alan Adams and Morten Ermebier. And this picture has nothing to do with my talk. I just thought it was cool to have string theorists playing with strings. So. Right. So here's the obligatory slide on explaining compactifications. So in some sense, string theory naturally lives in 10 dimensions. And so one way that we can get effective four-dimensional physics is to assume that that 10-dimensional spacetime has a product structure of flat four dimensions that we see, and small curled up six dimensions. And the six-dimensional manifold I'm going to call K for the rest of this talk. And the way that we get different four-dimensional physics from 10 dimensions is we can have strings that are small from our point of view, so they look like point particles. And the strings can wrap around some loop, some handle in the internal manifold, which stretches the string out and adds energy to it. And from the four-dimensional point of view, energy will look like mass. So that will give different masses to four-dimensional particles depending on how much it wraps. And we can also have strings with momentum around the internal manifold, which also adds energy to the strings. And that will also look like mass from a four-dimensional point of view. So we have this scenario where the four-dimensional physics that we see depends on the geometry of the internal manifold K. So different geometries will give us different four-dimensional physics. So the buzzword that you hear a lot is Clavinow. And Clavinow is a typical type of a six-dimensional manifold that satisfies some nice mathematical properties, some of which we'll mention in a little bit. The usefulness of Clavinow compactifications, first of all, they preserve supersymmetry, which is something we like to do because it makes our computational lives easier. And second of all, there's this nice feature about Clavinow compactifications that because of the mathematical structure on them, you wind up being able to turn a lot of qualitative physical questions into topological questions. For instance, as we'll see, the massless particle content is often described in terms of harmonic forms on the internal manifold, or Yukawa couplings can be described in terms of intersection numbers, and things like this. And it's very useful because we typically don't actually have an explicit form of the metric or parts of the geometry of the Clavinow. So it's the fact that we have this topological structure that lets us say a lot of interesting things. There are also bad sides to Clavinow compactifications. And one of the ones I'm going to be focused on is that they yield many massless scalars in four dimensions. And that's bad because we don't see many massless scalars in four dimensions. And you can also think of this as, we also sometimes call these moduli because the valves of the scalar fields can correspond to coupling constants and things like that. And so not having any potential for these fields winds up giving us a sort of continuous lack of predictivity, which is the same in any quantum field theory where you add some parameters and you can tune them. So it'd be nice if we could at least give potentials to these and not have these problems. So I'm going to be focused, by the way, you should just stop me if you have any questions along the way. So I'm going to be focused on examining non-Clavinow compactifications in the context of heterotic string theory. And the reason I'm interested in heterotic is sort of twofold, although the second reason is more important to me than the first. But the first reason is that there's a natural occurrence of gauge fields and chiral charged fermions, which is, you know, something that we see in the real world. We can get these in type 2 compactifications too, so this isn't really the most important part to me. The most important point is that in the heterotic theory, for the experts, there are no Ramon-Ramon fluxes, as you know, in the heterotic theory, which means that, in principle, all of the physics of the heterotic theory can be described by a two-dimensional conformal field theory, which is the field theory that lives on the world sheet of the string. So, in principle, you can compute physical processes just from the world sheet, which you can't do in type 2 theories. And as I mentioned on the last slide, I'm interested in non-Kähler geometries, which are non-Clavinow geometries, because there's the potential to have fewer massless scalar fields. So are there questions about the motivations? So let me remind you of the content of the heterotic string, and let me do that by writing down the typical WorldSheet nonlinear sigma model. So first of all, the x's from the WorldSheet point of view are scalar fields. From the space-time point of view, they carry an index m, and so they look like coordinates from the space-time point of view. And so they're scalar fields that live on the WorldSheet, which describe the embedding of the WorldSheet in space-time. And all of these capital fields, G, E, F, these are all functions of x. I didn't get a chance to fit that in, but they're all functions of x. G is the metric, for example, and we'll talk about the rest in a minute. All right, so the size are right-handed fermions from the WorldSheet point of view, and they also carry a space-time index, so they transform like vectors. We say that they transform as sections of the pullback of the tangent bundle of our space-time.
Is that a WorldSheet superspace we are writing this after?
I'm not using any superspace notation.
Is that one?
Yeah, there's an N equals one superspace expression. Okay, so the size are transformed as vectors in space-time. And then we have the gammas, which are left-moving fermions, which transform as in some representation of a space-time gauge group. So you can see, I should have emphasized here, but you see that the size transform as a space-time vector because they couple to an operator that's the pullback of the space-time connection that acts on vectors. And similarly, the gammas couple to the pullback of a space-time connection that couples, that involves a gauge potential. Okay, so now I can tell you what A is. A is space-time gauge potential, and F is the field strength of that space-time gauge potential. All right, and the last thing that I wanted to mention is B, which Sam mentioned in his introductory talk as well. And B is a two-form in space-time. And we say it's a two-form potential form field string, which we call H. H is dB. And that will play a role in the rest of the talk. So,
Very nice question. In the WorldSheet spin bundle, were you doing plus or minus 1 over R?
I don't know if it's standard notation or not, but I just mean that these are right-handed fermions and these are left-handed fermions.
I saw it.
Okay, bar. Okay.
So,
Josh,
the A
runs
from 132.
Yeah, so, right. So, I didn't say, but the gauge bundle in space time is typically either SO32 or E8 plus E. Other questions? Okay, so let me remind you of some of the salient features of Calabi-Yau compactifications. So first of all, the equations of motion for the space-time fields, we just saw the WorldSheet fields, but then there are space-time fields corresponding to gravitons and photons and gluons and things like that. So in general, for Calabi-Yau compactifications, the equations of motion for these fields are relatively simple. For example, for a scalar field, they might just be that the Laplacian of that scalar field vanishes. And in the Calabi-Yau case, we can split the 10-dimensional Laplacian into the 4-dimensional Laplacian plus the 6-dimensional Laplacian. And so you see if we expand phi in, I forgot to turn my microphone on. Okay, if we expand phi into eigenfunctions of the 6-dimensional Laplacian, we find out that the eigenvalue under the 6-dimensional Laplacian looks like a mass square term for the 4-dimensional point of view. So if we're interested in studying massless fields from the 4-dimensional point of view, we're interested in the eigenfunctions that are annihilated by the 6-dimensional Laplacian. And so we're naturally interested in harmonic forms, in this case, harmonic functions on the internal manifold. But more generally for the other fields, we're interested in harmonic forms. And we have this nice correspondence, which is always true between, there's an isomorphism between harmonic forms and representatives of Durham cohomology. When we're on a Kähler manifold, which a Calabi-Yau is,
we have this additional nice isomorphism between Durham cohomology and Dolbeau cohomology. And basically what that means is it lets us really see how every field from the 10-dimensional point of view gives rise to some massless 4-dimensional field. It gives us enough refinement that we can really count how many massless fields there are in 10 dimensions. And finally, a very important property about Calabi-Yau compactifications is that there exists a large radius limit. And what I mean by that is if you look at the beta function that you derive from the worldsheet CFT, which corresponds to some equation of motion for some space-time fields, and you set this equal to 0, then you see, well, even before you set it equal to 0, you see that the beta function is invariant under a constant rescaling of the metric and the B field. If you think for a minute, but maybe you can just trust me that it's invariant. And what that means is that you can rescale the metric and the B field to be as large as you like. And this is important. If I go back to the last slide, I didn't mention this coupling constant here, alpha prime. But when we do calculations in the conformal field theory, we wind up with some perturbative expansion in alpha prime. But alpha prime has dimensions of length squared. So really, we have an expansion in alpha prime over some length squared. And that length squared is some characteristic. It's associated with some characteristic length scale of the Calabi-Yau. So the important point is that when we have this large radius limit, we can rescale the Calabi-Yau to be as large as we like and to make the perturbative expansion arbitrarily accurate. So this is something that's very important in the Calabi-Yau case. So are there any questions about any of this? No? All right, so let's compare with the non-Kähler case. So everything you know is wrong in the non-Kähler case. Typically, equations of motion are no longer as simple as they were in the Calabi-Yau case. Even if they were, we wouldn't have the refinement we had in the Calabi-Yau case because it's no longer true that there's an isomorphism between Durham and Dolbeau cohomology. And finally, probably worst of all, there's no large radius limit. And I'll talk a little more about the Bianchi identity on the next slide, but there's a relationship between the three-form H and the Ricci form and the curvature of the gauge bundle. And all you need to know about this for the time being is that the left-hand side and the right-hand side don't scale the same way under this rescaling. And we'll see in the Calabi-Yau case, this doesn't matter because we separately set the left-hand side and the right-hand side to 0. But in the non-Kähler case, it does matter, and so we can't arbitrarily rescale our metric. And so there is no large radius limit in the Calabi-Yau case. So you need to worry about whether your conformal field theory will be a good description. So that's kind of an important point.
You can't have a free field, in other words. Is that not a good way to think
about it? Well, I guess you could say that if you want. It's basically that there's a differential operator that acts on H, which involves this H field. And you could think of H as being part of the geometry. So I guess in some sense you could say that, yeah. Are there other questions? All right, so let's just go into a little more detail about how these compactifications work. So the supersymmetry variations, what we want to vanish to demand that we have supersymmetry in 4 dimensions, tell us that our internal manifold K has to be complex. It has to have vanishing first term class, but it doesn't have to be Kähler. So in the standard Calabi-Yau compactification, we achieve these two things by assuming that K is Calabi-Yau. The second supersymmetry variation involves J, which is the Hermitian form. In the Kähler case, we call it the Kähler form. And in the Kähler case, J is closed, which means the left-hand side is 0, so H is 0. So in a Calabi-Yau compactification, H is 0. And finally, the field strength has to satisfy the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, which I won't go into in too much detail, but I'll write on another slide. So in addition to satisfying supersymmetry equations, we also have to satisfy the modified Bianchi identity. And the left-hand side is 0, since H is 0 in the Calabi-Yau compactification. So we need the right-hand side to be 0. We need trace r squared to cancel trace f squared. And one way we can achieve that is what's called by embedding the spin connection in the gauge connection. So as I said earlier, thanks to Cindy, the gauge group in spacetime is either SO32 or E8 cross E8. The spin connection of the Calabi-Yau has holonomy SU3. We can embed SU3 in either of those gauge groups. And so that's what we do. And we write the gauge potential in a block diagonal form where we set one block equal to the spin connection of spacetime and the other blocks to 0. And that guarantees for us that trace r squared equals trace f squared. So are there any questions about that? All right, so now in the non-Kähler case, again, everything you know is wrong. So we no longer can have K as Calabi-Yau by definition. So K is no longer Kähler. This left-hand side no longer vanishes, so H is no longer 0. And if H is no longer 0, this left-hand side is not vanishing. And so we can't do standard embedding. So life has just become a heck of a lot more difficult because we have a lot of complicated differential equations to solve. And in fact, these equations were written down in geometric form about 20 years ago, and no one wrote an explicit solution until about a year and a half ago. So they're certainly very difficult. So let me tell you about that solution now, which we call the Fu-Yau geometry. So the manifold, the K, is constructed as a T2 bundle over some base four-dimensional manifold that we'll call S. And S has to be Calabi-Yau twofold, so it's either K3 or T4. And I'll probably slip up and call S K3. So hopefully I won't confuse you if I accidentally do that. So the point is that we construct this T2 bundle as a product of two circle bundles over the base S. So that means that the two circle bundles can be described by their curvature two forms, omega 1 and omega 2. And so for those of you who are more familiar with gauge theory, you can just think of these two circle bundles as two U1 bundles. And the curvature forms, omega, are like the field strength. Okay, and we can parameterize these S1s at least locally by two coordinates, theta 1 and theta 2, that are periodic. And we can combine theta 1 and theta 2 into a complex coordinate that I call theta. Yeah. Sorry?
Oh, it's a Calabi-Yau twofold. Yeah, so it's K3 or T4 in the compact case. Other questions? All right, and finally, if you work out the details of the construction, you find out that the three form roughly looks like d theta wedge omega.
That's going to come back later. So in order to have a hadronic compactification, we still have to talk about a gauge bundle. And the usefulness of this construction is that there's a lot known about K3 and T4. And mathematicians have classified bundles over these spaces. And so it becomes very useful to construct our gauge bundle over K as the pullback of a gauge bundle over S, because much is understood about those gauge bundles. So that's what we do. And it turns out that the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations are solved on V if we demand that they're solved over S. So if the field strength for the gauge bundle E solves the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, then so will the pullback. All right, and finally, we have the Bianchi identity. And because everything in this construction has been pulled up from the base, we can push the Bianchi identity down to the base S. And we can look at solving the Bianchi identity there on the base. And in particular, we get a topological constraint by integrating both sides. And that says that we cannot have a solution unless the integrated form of the Bianchi identity holds. And in fact, what Fu and Yao proved is that any time that the integrated equation holds, there exists a solution to the full equations. Yeah?
You can calculate the moduli of the vector bundle so that the equation holds.
Yeah, well, you have to simultaneously choose
the vector bundle and also the two circle bundles so that they're self-consistent. So you have the ability to tune both sides.
Equations, right? By choosing finitely many parameters.
Sorry, what do you mean we're solving infinitely many
parameters? The identity has to hold at each point, right?
That's right, yeah.
So that's what I mean. You have equations, so you have constraints at each point, but you have only finite number of parameters to adjust. So what is the reason that it works?
Sorry, I don't really understand. It's a differential equation. I mean, you can solve differential equations even though it's an equation at every point in space. I guess I'm not sure what you mean. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
How generic is this solution?
It doesn't seem to be particularly generic, but it's sort of hard to say without knowing what the other solutions look like. So some detail that I'm not going into is you can take the sum of these curvature two forms, omega 1 plus I omega 2, and that sum cannot have any 0-2 component, but it can have a 1-1 component and a 2-0 component. It turns out if you turn the 2-0 component off so that they're just 1-1, that in fact this geometry should preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry. So I wouldn't think that these are particularly generic, because you would hope to have many, many n equals 1 preserving geometries.
Is this the only known construction?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are constructions that are argued from t-duality chains, but just duality chains. But this is the only explicit example that solves the differential equations from supersymmetry variation.
Is there a point in the string moduli space that there is soluble, that is soluble point?
What do you mean, like orbifold limits? We think that there are. We think that we can construct an orbifold model of this from the world sheet point of view, but we haven't done that yet.
Now, another thing of doing an orbifold of this, I'm saying, this theory has space has moduli, right?
Yep.
So that if you move to the moduli space, whether there is a special point for the theory, you have an exact CFT.
The overall k level is not there.
Sorry?
Usually you tune the overall k level modulus to get to the Doppler point. That point, that modulus is not there. Easily.
You have others.
Yeah, the overall volume modulus isn't there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want something that's described by an exact CFT, I think that you can actually achieve that by considering the base to be a T4 mod Z2 orbifold, for example. I think that you can achieve the structure from a conformal field theory if you turn on discrete torsion. But that's not something that we've really done yet. It's just, it's more a belief than anything that's known to be true.
So what are the moduli of this amplification?
Well, that's a great question. And that's something that that a number of mathematicians have been trying to solve and have not. And so that's something that we hope that the way that we're going to solve this model, we hope that that can tell us something about the moduli space. Because as we'll see in a few slides, we will be able to determine what the massless spectrum is. And at least we can see what the massless scalar fields are in four dimensions. So hopefully that'll tell us something about the moduli space. Other questions?
All right, so it'd be nice to, like I said in my motivations and heterotic, we can in principle study things with an exact conformal field theory. So it'd be nice if we could do that. Unfortunately, in general, in these models, there's no explicit metric, so we can't really even write down the theory we'd like to solve. And second of all, as we talked about, there is no large radius limit. And so in general, we may not be able to even trust the conformal field theory that we could write down, because perturbation series may not be good. And in fact, the circle bundles are typically of order the string scale. So we sort of expect that supergravity approximation isn't really even good. So it'd be nice to have another way to study this. And in fact, we do have another way to study this. We have gauge linear sigma models. Well, we hope to have gauge linear sigma models. And as we'll talk about, we do. And the point of a gauge linear sigma model is that conformal field theories are hard. In particular, when you don't know how to write them down, they're hard. So the idea is maybe we can find some theory which is much simpler, but is not a conformal field theory, that flows in the infrared to the conformal field theory that we're interested in. That's the basic idea behind the gauge linear sigma model. The gauge linear sigma model itself is a two-dimensional super renormalizable field theory. And in two dimensions, the gauge coupling goes to zero in the ultraviolet. So as long as we just have gauge couplings in these theories are free in the ultraviolet. So the idea is then, if you can compute some quantity in the ultraviolet that is protected by supersymmetry, then it flows, it's protected under RG flow, and flows to some quantity in the conformal field theory that you're interested in. So for example, the massless spectrum is something that does that. So we can compute the massless spectrum of the conformal field theory from the free theory in the ultraviolet. So this is, I mean, this is kind of an important point. It's the whole motivation behind gauge linear sigma model. So if I wasn't clear, please ask. Sure.
Are you assuming that the dilaton is not sourced?
No, the dilaton does have a non-constant profile. I just haven't talked about it because it won't come up in my talk. In the gauge linear sigma model, we don't see the dilaton, but it's not been ignored in the supergravity solutions. It's there. Other questions?
The only example is non-compact
plus,
right? So
it's singular. In the heterotic, where they satisfy the Bianchi identity?
I guess in type 2.
Yeah, certainly in type 2. Yeah. But the Bianchi identity is really, really the most difficult thing. So as far as I know, there are not non-compact examples in heterotic. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about gauge linear sigma models. So first, let me remind you of, or tell you if you don't already know, of the field content of 0-2 field theories in two dimensions. So we have chiral superfields, which are annihilated by this operator d bar plus. And the field content of the chiral superfields, the lowest component is a complex scalar field. And the other component is a right-handed fermion. We also have Fermi superfields, which are also annihilated by d bar. The lowest component of the Fermi superfield is a left-handed fermion, and the other component is a complex auxiliary field. Then, since it's a gauge linear sigma model, we have to talk about gauge fields. The gauge fields are described by two real superfields, B plus, B minus. B plus contains the plus component of the ordinary gauge field. B minus contains the minus component. It also contains Gaugino, which is a left-handed fermion, and it contains a real auxiliary field, D. All right, and then from these, let me go to the next point, and then I'll come back. So we have this gauge symmetry, which is enhanced to be described by a chiral superfield, lambda. And I've actually cheated a little bit when I wrote down B plus, because I already used most of lambda to get rid of the first three terms in G plus. The only part of lambda I didn't use is the real part of the lowest component, which is just a real scalar field. And that real scalar field just corresponds to ordinary gauge transformations. And so this is how the fields behave under gauge transformation described in superspace. And upsilon is something that's gauge invariant under this gauge transformation. And basically, you can't see it since I didn't tell you how B minus transforms. But if I had, you would see that the quantity inside parentheses just transforms by the addition of lambda. And since lambda is chiral, upsilon is gauge invariant. So upsilon, we call the superfield string. OK, so any questions about the lightning review of 0-2 supersymmetry? Okay, so let's go on and build our model. So in the upper right-hand corner here, we have the fields of our model, phi i's,
And the P's are chiral superfields, and their charges under our U1 gauge group are given there, QI minus N. And the pi and the gamma M's are both Fermi superfields. So in addition to the gauge invariant supersymmetric kinetic terms, which I haven't written down, obviously, we're also going to have a superpotential, which is going to play an important role. So the superpotential we split into three pieces. F of phi here is a function that's holomorphic. It's a polynomial that's holomorphic in the phis. And the EMs are also polynomials that are holomorphic in the phis. The last part of the superpotential is the phi at Eliopoulos term. And T here is a complex parameter whose real component I'll call R, and whose imaginary component I'll call theta. And as you'll see, theta is a two-dimensional theta angle. So now, just looking at these terms and demanding gauge invariants, you realize that f of phi has to be a homogeneous polynomial in the phis of degree d to cancel the transformation of pi. And the e's have to be homogeneous polynomials of degree n minus qm to cancel the gauge transformation of p times gamma m. And this homogeneity, sorry.
Full theory as well. Usually for the
unimodules, So in ordinary gauge linear string models, it's like a Kähler modulus. It's the volume modulus. Here, it's not exactly clear if it's a modulus or not. I mean, you can tune it to be whatever you like in the field theory, in the two-dimensional field theory, but it's not entirely clear what it corresponds to in space-time in our models.
The usual mod, the equation being modified by
no, we do have that. We do have that. But it's not clear whether the overall volume of this total six-dimensional manifold will be affected by tuning R. Where it certainly is clear in the ordinary gauge linear sigma model, but maybe once I describe the rest of the model, it'll be clear that at least it's a little more complicated. So other questions?
You said the parameter that you tune to find out about soluble points.
That's right.
In the modular space. So you, I mean, if you know how to solve this parameter, you can try to see.
Sure.
And in the usual linear string model, you can explicitly schedule X from under this model.
Yeah, we do get that. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize that's.
Yes,
yeah, we do get that. We do get a Landau-Ginzburg model that describes the theory.
How can you get that and understand? Because that's the overall modulus that you have to really.
So I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if geometrically it actually corresponds to changing the volume, but it's certainly.
But that follows from the beta which modifies phi's r to phi of t in space time.
Yeah, so the phi's are only going to describe the base s, and then we're going to have the torus fibered over that, and that's going to be different from the usual gauge linear sigma model story. So I'm not exactly sure. So certainly you can rescale the base by doing this, but it's not exactly clear what happens to the total volume of the total space when you do this. That's okay. Anything else? Okay. So I guess I'm getting a little low on time, so let me just kind of breeze through this. So let me put all these on the board here. So we have the Lagrangian, which we can describe as kinetic terms plus Yukawa couplings plus these terms, which involve the auxiliary fields. And here I was writing down what they are and integrating out the auxiliary fields. But the full expression's on the next page anyway, so let me just tell you what you get when you do that. What you get is a scalar potential, LD, LF, LE. And so then we want to set the scalar potential to zero to preserve supersymmetry on the world sheet. So let's explore what happens when we do that. And this is just a review of the standard gauge linear sigma model story. So initially, the phi I's are complex scalar fields, and so they parameterize a Cn plus 1. I'm assuming they're n plus 1 phi I's. And I'm going to ignore P on this slide, but on the next slide, we'll come back and address it. So ignoring P, setting LD to 0, you see, looks like the equation for an ellipsoid. And so we get some space when we set LD to 0 that's isomorphic to a 2n plus 1 sphere.
Then we have the U1 gauge symmetry. So once we gauge fix, we take a quotient of this space by an S1. And the way that it all works out, we wind up with a weighted projective space. So, all right. So finally, on the last step, we set LF equal to 0. For F of phi equals 0 to make sense, sitting inside of a weighted projective space, F of phi has to be a homogeneous polynomial. And it is, because we saw on the last slide we needed it to be for gauge invariance. So indeed, we can we find that the phis, after we set the scalar potential to 0, describe some hypersurface, which I'll call S, sitting inside a weighted projective space. So we can use this to construct K3, for example, as a hypersurface in P3. So are there questions about that? OK, so let's set the rest of the terms to 0. So now we have to make an assumption that F and the E's only all simultaneously vanish when the phis are 0. And so assuming that, then given that LF equals 0, LE equals 0 implies that P equals 0. Because if F is 0, at least one of these E's is not 0 by assumption. So P has to vanish. If we hadn't made that assumption, we would have, in fact, found out that the phis don't give us the compact space S that we had said on the last slide. But in fact, there are points, the points at which all of the E's and F vanish. At those points, that surface blows up and becomes non-compact. So since I'm just describing embeddings in weighted projective space here with one U1 field, I just want four of them. Yeah, four of them. But we can add more gauge fields, and then we have more phis and do some complete intersection and some more general torque variety or something. But yeah, and what I've written here, you want four or five.
I think maybe we're a bit short of time.
OK. All right, so then, so finally, and I'll flash this on a later slide, that if we take this parameter r much less than minus 1, I forgot to say all of the story that we analyzed before was for r much greater than 1. So when we take the other limit, we find out that u vanishing implies that p gets above and phis have to be 0. And this gives us a Landau-Ginzburg phase. OK, and I didn't even put it on the slide anyway, so I can skip through this pretty quickly. If we analyze the Yukawa couplings, we'd find out that the combinations of fermions that stay massless as you flow to the IR, you can write down what they are in some exact sequence and some chain. And you find out that the right moving fermions transform as sections of the tangent bundle of S, and the left moving fermions transform as the sections of some gauge bundle E. So at the end of the day, we have exactly the structure of the nonlinear signal model on S, which is the scalar fields parameterize S. The right moving fermions are sections of the tangent bundle of S, and the left moving fermions are the sections of a gauge bundle. So that's how the typical story goes. And then we have to talk about the B field. So we have this theta angle that we haven't talked about so far. If I write it in the slightly more suggestive form, you see that it looks a lot like the B field in the nonlinear sigma model. And in fact, you find out that when you integrate out the gauge field, you do get a B field that involves the theta angle. And it basically looks like theta times H, where this H is the generator of the second cohomology of the weighted projective space. Theta being a constant and H being in cohomology means that the H flux, EB, has to vanish. So in the typical gauge linear sigma models, we don't have any H flux. So now when I write it this way, perhaps the generalization is obvious. What you want to do is you want to make the theta angle dynamical. So in fact, because we want supersymmetry, you have to have two theta angles so that we have a complex parameter. And they're both periodic. And by doing this, we can get a non-zero H flux. But that H flux, well, OK, let me say it this way. So we'll have a geometry that's described by T2 over our surface S. But it won't really twist in the way we want it to twist. unless we make these axions shift charged. So that'll guarantee that as we move around the base, the torus is twisting in some way. Okay. And in fact, when we do this and we make appropriate replacements in the action so that we have supersymmetric action, we find out that we do get an H flux, which is non-zero, and it looks like the same form as that we had in the Fu Yao construction, E theta wedge omega. However, by making these axions shift charged, the theta angle term is no longer invariant under gauge transformations. So overall, our classical action is variant under gauge transformation. So it looks like we're in trouble, but we haven't talked about anomalies because we have chiral fermions that are charged under a gauge group. We'll wind up with some anomalous variations of the measure, and these anomalous variations take exactly the same form as the variance of the action. So we can, in fact, play these two things off each other. The anomalous variation of the measure can cancel the classical variation of the action. And this is exactly the usual Green-Schwarz mechanism applied to a gauge linear sigma model. And at the end of the day, we get that the partition function is invariant if this Diophantine equation is satisfied. And in fact, if you took the descriptions I wrote down earlier of the tangent bundle and the gauge bundle, you'd be able to write down the Turn characters of the two bundles in terms of the charges of the theory and the hyperplane class, and you would actually find out that these two equations exactly match each other. So the anomaly cancellation in the gauge linear sigma model is exactly reproducing for us the Bianchi identity. This is something that's known in ordinary gauge linear sigma models, but we take the correspondence in our model to be a good indication that our model describes what we want it to describe. So any questions about that before I move on? Sorry. No. Okay, so now we have to talk about computing the massless spectrum. So that was what we did in our paper last year, where we set up the structure of the gauge linear sigma model that should describe these Fu Yao geometries. Now what we're doing is computing the massless spectrum. And the way that this works is that, first of all, you exploit, well, the whole way along, you exploit the supersymmetry of the gauge linear sigma model. And so for the right movers, at the end of the day, we want to have some operator which corresponds to L naught in the conformal field theory. And the way that we can do that for the right movers is we have supersymmetry on the right side. And in the conformal field theory, we have the relationship that the anticommutator of Q with Q bar gives us L naught. And so states that are annihilated by the right moving L naught are in one-to-one correspondence with states that are in Q bar cohomology. So we can compute Q bar cohomology to tell us about the massless states. But really, to be massless, we also need some left moving L naught to vanish on these states. And on the left, we don't have supersymmetry anymore, which could make our life a little bit harder. But it actually turns out that in the ultraviolet, you can find some chiral operator T, which has the OPE of a stress tensor. And being chiral, it thus implements the action of some stress tensor, at least on the chiral algebra of your theory. So we take this, it's an assumption that we take this stress tensor and we assume that it gives us the stress tensor of the IR fixed point. And that assumption works very well in the Kähler cases where it can be checked against other methods. And the existence of that stress tensor depends crucially on the existence of a U1R symmetry being non-anomalous. So we can take that as our definition of the left-moving L naught, and the massless fermions are computed by Q-bar cohomology intersected with the vanishing of the left-moving L naught. So, all right, on this next slide, I was just going to say that by going to the Landau-Ginzburg point, we can actually do these computations very effectively. We get some extra nice structure about the supercharges, which let us compute the massless spectrum. And there's also the twist that it's not actually a Landau-Ginzburg phase, but it's a Landau-Ginzburg orbifold. So you have to add twisted sectors and do some extra work. But at the end of the day, you get some nice results.
The spectrum in a specific point in the moduli space?
Um,
Yeah. I mean, in particular, you have to choose sort of explicit forms of the homogeneous polynomials that define the gauge bundle and all of this. But at the end of the day, you can actually analyze all of this just assuming somewhat more generic forms of these homogeneous polynomials. And so what you'll find is that at least the net number, for example, the net number of generations, you know, being the difference between the, say, right-moving and left-moving fermions, or the positive and negative chirality fermions, that will be unchanged. But the specific number of each may depend on the choices that you make. So other questions? OK, that's good. I'm on my last slide next. OK, so that animation didn't work quite right. Oh, there we go. I forgot to delete a slide. All right. So let me just talk about our results and outlook. We haven't really satisfied ourselves with computations, but we've done a couple examples. And what we see is that, unfortunately, there are still many massless scalars. So at least the examples we've chosen haven't completely fixed that problem. On the other hand, we have a little puzzle that's not logically a puzzle, but to some people it looks like a puzzle. In Calabi-Yau compact applications, the number of generations of fermions is counted by the third Chern character of the gauge bundle, the third Chern class of the gauge bundle. In our examples, the third Chern class of the gauge bundle is zero. Of course, we're not on Calabi-Yau compactifications. But some people believe that this identification still holds, and some people don't. So it's something that's debated and is not mathematically solved what the answer is. In our model, we get some non-zero number of generations. So this could be telling us an answer to the question on how point A gets modified in a non-Calabi-Yau case, or it could just be telling us that maybe the supergravity solution just gets corrected substantially, or who knows what.
But anyway, so that's why puzzles in quotes, and it's something that we found interesting, especially because when these models were mentioned to Witten by someone else who was working on the supergravity point of view, he sort of offhandedly dismissed them because C3 was zero. OK, so future directions, just very broadly speaking, we can consider different bases other than S, which may lead us to non-supersymmetric compactifications. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with studying those. And we could also use these to study G2 compactifications by taking the base to be a Calabi-Yau threefold instead of a Calabi-Yau twofold. And then we can take one of the circle bundles to be trivial and take its radius to be large. So at the end of the day, we'll wind up with some seven-dimensional compactification. Well, sorry, three large-dimensional compactification, which hopefully would describe some aspects of G2 compactifications. So other questions? Sure.
In your model, is r plus I theta is what is related to this LG omniform point.
That's right, yeah.
And that's the scalar parameter of Calabi-Yau. In this case, you're saying this does not have, is it still a modulus in the theorem? Is r plus I theta?
R is a modulus in the, it's a modulus in the gauge linear sigma model.
It's not a modulus of the non-scalar piece. How do you know that this has anything to do with the complete spectrum of the
It could still be some modulus, but it's just not the overall volume modulus of the Calabi-Yau. It could be some other modulus because of the various conditions from the supersymmetry and the Bianchi identity. You don't get, for instance, you don't get a clear separation into Kähler. And I mean, there is no Kähler. So you don't get a clear separation into like Kähler and complex structure moduli space. So you have some complicated interrelation between these two types of moduli. And so R could be parameterizing something along those lines. But we don't expect that it parameterizes some overall volume modulus.
And you have two theta angles, theta 1, theta 2.
That's correct.
Do they also come with their respective R's?
No. That's something that we discussed in our paper, which didn't really seem, in retrospect, it didn't seem to us the best way to present our model. But initially, the way we constructed it, they did come with each with their own R. And then we found that if you tune parameters in the theory to certain values, you can find a separate n equals 2 supersymmetry which paired theta 1 with theta 2 and R1 with R2. And in fact, in that regime, in that with that choice of parameters, you find out that those R fields entirely decouple from the theory. But then, so now our viewpoint now is just to take this as our starting point instead of that, instead of what I just described.
It has nothing to do with the R cosine theta, the other thing, right? It's a different, it's a distinct two parameters, theta 1, theta 2, or fields.
It's the same if you took two superfields, one which describes R1 plus I theta 1 as its first lowest component, and the other which describes R2 plus I theta 2 as its lowest component. You could find that if you tune parameters correctly, that you could find a different supersymmetry that paired R1 with R2 and theta 1 with theta 2. So you can separate them and choose this other supersymmetry as the one you want to work with. And in that case, the R is just completely decoupled.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank the speaker.